Once again, good morning. This morning when the alarm went off, they were playing The Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's a very powerful image, it's a very strong music that really conveys a story. And it's rather gripping, kind of terrifying, actually, if you know the story. If you can picture the story, if you know the music, you picture that story. Really quite terrifying, but you have to do this without thinking of Mickey Mouse. That kind of that does something to it. That if any of you have, some of you obviously have seen Fantasia. It is really a terrifying story. I first became acquainted with it as a child, way back. I suspect, I don't know really where I first heard it, but I think I'm old enough so that I go back before television. And as a kid, I remember we used to, my brother and I would sit and listen to Big John and Sparky. You remember that? Yeah. We have a Big John and Sparky fan here. That was some time ago now. But Saturday morning, we'd listen to that. And I don't know if that is where I heard this story. Maybe Big John was telling the story. I really don't remember too much about that program. I wouldn't mind hearing that again if there was any recordings of it. Big John was just a guy. Sparky, I don't know what Sparky was, but they had some interesting stuff on that show. And at least I thought so when I was 5 or 6 years old anyway. But I do remember somewhere getting this story and connecting it with that music and knowing what the story was before I had the opportunity of seeing Mickey Mouse acted out. And what it left me with was this impression of something really frightening, scary. But I loved it. You know, as a child too, like most children, I think, I was also kind of fascinated by dinosaurs. But they're also kind of scary, you know. They have big teeth and they're big, you know. But we have a kind of fascination with things like that. And so it was with this Sorcerer's Apprentice. You know the story, it's about an apprentice to a sorcerer who was then given the assignment of having to fill the bathwater for the sorcerer. But he's kind of lazy. And he thought, well, why should I do it? I'll cast a spell on this broom and have the broom do that manual labor that I really don't care to do. So it's kind of an interest in power and arranging this power, working with this power in such a way that we can make life easier for ourselves. So we can spare ourselves from doing something we don't want to do. We can have power over others, or in this case, wow, real power, over a broom, over something in the natural world. But the problem is, of course, the apprentice really doesn't know everything the apprentice needs to know. The apprentice gets the broom to operate, picks up the buckets and starts hauling the water to the bath and back to the well again. But when it comes time to tell the broom to stop, he doesn't know the command. He doesn't know. He tries various things. He can't get the broom to stop. Pleads with the broom. The broom speaks back to him, I can't stop. I need the command. He can't come up with the command. And so it was just, now the tub is overflowing. Everything is beginning to go haywire here. In desperation, the apprentice takes an axe and he thinks, well, finally, in desperation, he's going to cut this broom. And he does, he cuts it in two. In the Disney story, it's cut into thousands of pieces and they all become brooms. But in the original story, it's just cut in two and then they both turn into brooms with hands and they continue to march on, hauling the water. So it's a very desperate kind of story. I've started something here now, but I don't have the power to stop it. I didn't really realize what I was getting into. I thought I was going to do something that would make it easier for me, better for me. And I think that this story is kind of a metaphor. I didn't understand all of this when I was as a child, certainly. But I did sense the terror in it and the horror of this power gone awry and out of control. And I think that this reaches deep down into the human psyche, that we have this sense about ourselves that we have a lot of power and we want to use it, and very often we're kind of impulsive. Yes, that's the word I wanted. Well, we're not really, we just act on it. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Let's do it. Without really seeing the full implications of what it is that we're doing. Science and technology today, of course, has given us enormous power. And it's reaching into all facets of our life. Recently, Bill Joy, who's the head scientist at Sun Microsystems, I think is the company, he wrote a very interesting article on nanotechnology, the technology of being able to construct little machines, little robots on a molecular level, microscopic things. Maybe we can get these programmed to do various kinds of things that will make life easier for us, better for us. But these things also have the ability to self-replicate, because as they're moving through the environment, they can find the molecules they need to reconstruct models of themselves, which then, it is like the Disney version. It's and then these things will go on and on. And they will be in the environment like a virus. And once something like this is let loose, how would we ever stop it? It's like the genie's out of the bottle. Now, how are you ever going to put it back? And he points out how, you know, he was horrified by realizing that this kind of technology that they're working with is offering this. It's right on the horizon right now. Not only that, the ability to do this, all you need is a very powerful computer. We now have personal computers in people's homes that are powerful enough that could begin to do things like this. So that anybody with a little bit of knowledge and experience in this area, it doesn't have to be done by Bell Labs. It can be done by people in their homes. This is what he's predicting. Things like this could be happening in another, within 10 years maybe. And so he was trying to sound the alarm. Actually, this isn't really what I was going to talk about, but just to kind of show that we have this incredible power that we can unloose on the world. Of course, we're always thinking very subjectively, you know, wouldn't this be great if we could do this or if we could do that? Or maybe just, I don't care if this is pernicious or not, I want to just see if I can do it. There's a lot of that kind of thinking too. So as human beings, we have this, and I think we know this about ourselves, and I think we've known this about ourselves from way back, because the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, I don't know how far back that goes, but it's certainly probably back to the Middle Ages at least. So I think we've known this, and there are other stories like this. Some of the Faust versions are very reminiscent of this. And of course we have the Frankenstein story. There's another story I know of, a Zen story of a fellow who... I don't know how far back this goes, but he's in a marketplace someday and he finds a demon. This guy is selling different kinds of things. And one guy is, and he's got this demon for sale. Cheap. You know. 1 yen or something like that. You know, and he's, I don't know what it is, but it's cheap. Well, this demon will do anything. You just tell it what you want it to do and it'll do anything. You know, just do all your work for you, your laundry, you know, go shopping for you. It'll just, you know. So the only catch is that you've got to give it something to do. Well, that doesn't sound so bad. I got plenty of things I can, you know. So he buys a demon, takes it home, and that demon's just great. He's doing all these things for the man. You know, now fix the roof, do this, plant the garden, you know. Of course, he has to keep coming up with things for the demon. And eventually, one day he goes to market himself, or he goes off somewhere, I don't know where, the man does. And when he comes back, he finds the demon roasting the neighbor's kid on a spit. Of course, it's a gruesome story. But it's the same kind of thing. Here we find this in Eastern culture, too. It's like this is a universal suspicion, I think, that we have about ourselves. And that we might be so foolish as to let this get away with this. Well, I was thinking, what kind of mind is this? that dabbles in these kinds of things, that looks for things that might make it easy for ourselves, etc. Wouldn't it be powerful, this dreaming mind, if I could create this or if I could create that, and then this would be just fine. And we don't realize the larger ramification of everything we do. We're just looking at it in terms of ourselves. Let's think about what kind of mind. Of course, this is the mind that we commonly suffer from. It's the egoistic mind. It is ego. It goes the whole thing at the crux of all of these stories, and what the problem is with ego. It's with ourselves, preoccupation with pleasing and protecting ourselves. And in the process, we don't realize to the extent we want security, we make ourselves insecure. To the extent we want knowledge, we make ourselves perplexed and baffled by reality. Wherever it is that we go, with driven by ego in this way, we always seem to net the opposite or the converse of whatever it is that we think that we were doing. That's that kind of mind. But what kind of mind is not like this? That's what I was thinking about, and that's what I wanted to talk about today. That is there such a mind that doesn't get taken in these ways? And by the way, this is not to say that we shouldn't make use of technology, etc. I think we can. But I think we deeply need to appreciate, you know, some of the more subtle aspects of this. And it really does have to do with this thing about self and this confusion that we have about self. But what I want to talk about is the mind that is not like this ordinary kind of mind. And as I was thinking about this, I thought of Cold Mountain, who is he's not a monk. He's a person who lived during the Tang Dynasty in China. And very interesting fellow. His name is Han Shan, but it means Cold Mountain. And he took his name after this place where he lived, this place called Cold Mountain, which is in the Tentai mountain range in China. And near this area was a monastery, Guochung Monastery, which he would go and visit from time to time. And in this monastery, the person there who's the head of the dining hall, I think it was, Shi Te, a fellow by the name of Shi Te, they became good friends. Han Shan would come to this place. He was very poor, and he would just find scraps of food there that Shi Te would leave out for him. And there's all kinds of imagery in Zen of these two characters. They're kind of the two Zen fools or clowns. They're often pictured with a broom and laughing at things. You know, I remember one painting I've seen of them where they're standing there laughing at just a leaf falling from a tree, and they're just, you know, one was holding a broom, I think, and but of course with this broom, they don't have the same kind of desire to make this broom do what the sorcerer's apprentice did. They work with this broom in a much different way, because this Han Shan has this much different mind. He was a very free spirit, and he really didn't care what people thought of him or anything else, and many people thought he was a fool. Dirty, disheveled, poor, come around looking for scraps of food at the monastery. And he wasn't a monk, but the abbot there at that monastery said that Han Shan had more wisdom than most of the monks in his monastery that were training in his monastery. But sometimes he'd leave, some of the monks would go chasing after him and, you know, making fun of him because he was such a fool. And he'd laugh right along with him and kind of joke right along with him. But he'd go on his way. He'd go back to Cold Mountain, where he's from. And he used to write a lot of poems. He'd write them on trees, on rocks, on walls. And eventually somebody went around and collected. There's over 300 of these poems that are collected, and I have one here that I'd like to read for you. But it's really quite interesting. A different kind of mind than this mind, this driven mind that we are all so familiar with, and that lurking in the back of our minds, where we are afraid of, we're terrorized by our own power and ability. Here's a different kind of mind. Cold Mountain, he said, people ask the way to Cold Mountain. There's no trail. In summer, ice doesn't melt. The rising sun blurs and swirling fog. How did I make it? My heart's not the same as yours. If your heart was like mine, you'd be here. All I can say to those I meet, try and make it the cold mountain. I'll read that again. People ask the way to Cold Mountain. There's no trail. In summer, ice doesn't melt. The rising sun blurs in swirling fog. How did I make it? My heart's not the same as yours. If your heart was like mine, you'd be here. All I can say to those I meet, try and make it to Cold Mountain. Of course, when he's talking about Cold Mountain, you see, he's talking about himself. He's talking about his mind. He's talking about the place where he lives, Cold Mountain. So people ask the way to Cold Mountain. People ask, well, how can I be like you? How can I be free like that in my mind? People ask the way. But he said, there's no trail. There is no way here. People want to know, they're really asking, how can, they don't, we don't realize what we're asking Cold Mountain when we ask him this. We think, how can I be like you? We're looking out there, you know, I want to be like you. I'm a little afraid of being like you. I'm afraid of, if that's freedom, I'm kind of afraid of that. I want something around me that I can grasp and control, be comfortable. I want the familiar things here, things I know. But still, I see this freedom in your mind. There's something alluring about that. How can I find something like that? What's the way to a Cold Mountain? And he says, there's no trail. But he isn't doing that, you see. It isn't like he's here and there's something else there. Or like you're here and now you have to go to that place. You're there. You're at that place. Now, we always are. You cannot leave it. It's just that Cold Mountain understands that. We don't understand that. We think there's something here and I want to do something about that out there. I want to either get over there, I want to get away from that. I want to use that in some way. I want power over that. I want to control that. We're always looking in these terms. And of course, once again, this is ego. This is just ego acting, ego speaking. It is not really seeing just where we are and what is taking place and that everything is already right here. So he says in summer, ice doesn't melt. The rising sun blurs in the swirling fog. Rising fun, yeah. This doesn't sound like much fun, does it? It's pretty austere and cold. And in a way, too, it sounds egotistical, this poem, doesn't it? Especially when he's saying, my mind's not like yours. But it is not. I want to take you through this poem, show you that, it might look like that. Remember, he also looks like a fool, like an idiot. The abbot of the monastery says he's very wise. He's probably more wise than all my monks. He said he's more wise than most of my monks. Maybe he's more wise than all of us. Interesting, too, that he's a layman. Completely free. But if this sounds cold and austere, you know, that only looks that way because we are looking at it from the vantage point of our ego. And this looks like something kind of stark and frightening and maybe uninviting. But if we could really understand the mind of Hanshan, the mind that is like this, the mind that is not like that mind I outlined earlier, well, this isn't cold and austere at all. This is really quite warm and compassionate. But he says, in summer, ice doesn't melt. The rising sun blurs in the swirling fog. Being from Minnesota originally, mostly a lot of you know this anyway, that I love the boundary waters up north in the lake country and in the wilderness up there. And I've been going up there since I was a teenager. And pretty much all my life, there were a few stints where I was away from Minnesota. So I didn't get up there every summer. But by golly, I think just about every year that I've been in Minnesota. Well, not quite. But I try to get up there a lot. But I remember in my youth going up there and really enjoying it. But anyway, what I'm saying here is that I used to, whenever I think of the boundary waters, say in winter I'd be thinking about it and I'd think, oh boy, I want to go up there again, you know, do some canoeing. But I'd always picture it on a sunny day. You know, it was always sunny and warm and, you know, the smell of the pine trees and the warm rocks and, you know, the clear water and the blue skies, maybe a few fluffy clouds passing by. Not too much wind, just really nice. This is my image of the boundary waters. Of course, when you're up there, a lot of times it's raining, it's windy, it's cold. It's of course, we get those nice sunny days too. But what I put together in my mind didn't really match reality. It just matched what I wanted, what I imagined I wanted, what I felt I needed. And then in those days, when it was kind of cold and rainy, I didn't like that so much. I still enjoyed being out there, but yeah, I really would like the rain to end, you know, and find a nice dry spot where you could sit down or, you know, things like this. In other words, because I would think in this way, because I would see it in a particular way, the way that my idealized state, at the same time I'm making myself miserable. So here he's saying here that in summer, ice doesn't melt. There's no trail to this place. Where is he? He's right in this place. In summer, ice doesn't melt. And in the, with the rising sun and the early morning fog, you know, it is all right there together. The fog, the sun, the summer, and the ice. It's all together in one place here. Not parsed out. In other words, it's kind of like a mind of totality. And when I was thinking of this, then I thought of, and this is kind of bad form here, but to read another poem inside of another poem, but I'm going to inject one here by Wallace Stevens. I was thinking about this mind of totality, where everything is right here, not singling out that thing that you long for, that you insist must be, or that you always picture it must be. No, rather just settle down in the place where you are. And this poem by Wallace Stevens came to mind. Perhaps the wrong time of the year for this, too. It's called The Snowman. Do you know this poem? A great poem. I'll read this. He said, "One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and to have been cold for a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener, who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is." I'll read that again. "One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold for a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener, who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is." Well, this is that same kind of mind. Wallace Stevens understands this. Wallace Stevens, too, by the way, interesting. He's a layman, not a monk. But he understands this mind. Not only is he a layman, He was a businessman, very wealthy, an executive of some corporation. I'm not sure what he did. Maybe some of you know. Very interesting man. I believe his heart was with this poetry, but he needed to support himself, so he became rich in the process. But interesting, like Han Shan, not a monk, very poor, but taps into a spacious mind that is outside of himself. This is kind of important, I think, to realize this, particularly when we come around Zen, particularly when some of us end up becoming ordained. It's easy to think of splinters here, separations, removing the goats from the sheep, this sort of thing. But if we even think that there's something to that, then we don't understand ultimately this mind of freedom that Zen is all about, showing us this mind of totality, and that it can be expressed, it can be found in anyone's life, because it's already right here. There's no trail to this place. We're already right here, all of us. And we only need to see this and to realize this and to develop this. But it shows up just like this. One must have a mind of winter to regard the boughs crusted with snow. You need to have that mind and been cold for a long time to really know this, to be there, to be one with it, to be inseparable from it. To not be thinking of summer, longing for summer, something different and separate. Of course, this mind of winter is, if it's summer, it's the mind of summer. It is not a mind that complains about it being too hot. It is not a mind that complains about being too cold. He says, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind. We're not thinking of the misery. If we're thinking of misery, we're in this cold, stark, barren place with the wind blowing, and then we're miserable. Because we're not here. We're somewhere else, and we're reaching for some other place, but there isn't any other place. We're here. If we were truly here, we'd be, well, not just okay with being here. There'd be no problem at all. But we separate ourselves in some way, and now we want to control things. We want to change it. We would even change winter if we could. But if you're in winter, it is winter. Of course, with all of our technology and that, we can say, well, I really don't want winter, so I'm going to go south. And we can do that pretty easily now. We can just keep hopping from hemisphere to hemisphere as the seasons change, But what about the mind that needs to do that? It's a dissatisfied mind, an unhappy mind, always looking for something else. And we never really quite arrive at that place, that freedom experienced by Han Shan. So he says not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow. And nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Interesting piece there, I think. But I think it kind of brings out something about this very mind here that Han Shan is speaking of. And Han Shan goes on, he says, how did I make it? So you've asked me now, what's the way to Cold Mountain? There's no trail. So how did I make it? He says. Well, you've asked. Someone asked him. He's responding to someone, no doubt. Someone asked him. He probably gets this from time to time. Because we all want to know, how do we become enlightened? How do we become free? What exactly is the bondage that we suffer from in the first place? How did I make it? He said, my heart's not the same as yours. If your heart was like mine, you'd be here. So this isn't like, my heart's not like yours. if we approach it with our ego, we will see it that way. Oh, look at him. Who is he? But you asked, you know. You asked him, and now he spoke. Somebody asked him. Fortunately, he wrote it down on a tree or whatever, and it was collected. Lucky for us to have such wonderful pointing words as these. How did I make it? My mind's not the same as yours. You know, there's just two ways of looking at this. There's these two minds. Either we have this leaning mind, this mind needing to change that, you know, and to fix that, or we don't. Or we have a mind that sees, or we don't. We're not seeing. If we see, then we see what is here. We don't see what is not here. We don't see the nothing that is not here. We see what is here. Very often we see an awful lot that isn't here. Why do we see these things that aren't here? Well, it's because we're afraid. We want to be protected. We want to be preserved in some way. And so we're afraid. So we see many things that aren't here. We create many stories. We see signs and symbols, and we dabble in all kinds of mystical kinds of things, and, you know, divining this or that. Because we are insecure, we're afraid, but we're not interested in noticing what our problem is. We're interested in just immediately finding some fix for this. Something to gloss it over, something that I can hold in my hand that'll make me feel secure and comfortable. Hanshan, or the snowman, is not one who needs to do this, who has to hang on to something for security. That isn't security, that is insecurity. And the more you hang on to it, or the more elaborate becomes the things that you need to put there to make yourself secure, the more insecure you become. Deep down in the back of our minds, we know, just like we know something about ourselves in terms of our powers to control that, but that we're really doing something that's going to undermine us in some way. And even though we know this about ourselves, still we'll dabble in the magic, and we'll dabble in the this, and we'll dabble in the that. And through the sciences, we, in all aspects of our life, and through religion, through philosophy, through whatever it is, we will do this. We play this game. Our mind is not like Han Shan's. His mind is not like this. Of course, it isn't Han Shan's mind. It's not a particular person's mind. He's talking about enlightenment. The awakened mind is not a mind that has to dabble in this way. Nevertheless, we are in the world, but we don't need to control it. We don't need to defend ourselves against it. We don't need to preserve anything. We only need to really be here. Totally, completely, freely responding to the occasion. And only stepping in to the line of intention when that rare moment comes when we can act toward awakening. This is very simple, but we're very complicated. We make it very complicated for ourselves. When we hear words from a free, spontaneous, awakened mind like this, we misunderstand. We'll even accuse him. Hey, well, look at you. How egoistical you are. So the way he's speaking, the way he's pointing, but to say that my mind's not the same as yours, this is actually something that's very warm, friendly, intimate, you know, bringing us together. Because if it was like mine, you'd be here. In other words, what he's pointing to is the truth, is reality. It is only one way. There's only one Dharma, one reality, one truth. The truth is the truth. It cannot be something else. There cannot be models of it. There cannot be diagrams of it. The truth is just simply the truth. In other words, if one is awake, then one is awake. If one has the mind of a Buddha, then one has the mind of a Buddha. Someone once asked the Buddha, when the Buddha was about to die, didn't want to let him go. And he said, well, where, you know, can I see you again? You know, when can I see you again? Where can I see you? And the Buddha said, if you want to see me, see the Dharma. See reality. See the truth. It looks the same to everyone who sees. It's the only kind of thing that's like that. Everything else looks a little different for each one of us. That's a dead giveaway, too. If you're not really seeing the truth, you're holding to something that's not going to quite look the same to someone else who's seeing it. But when we awaken, whatever it is you see, and it isn't, there's no real it there. But what is seen is understood and seen by anyone who is awake. It is a mind of winter. It is a mind of totality, a mind of this mind of Han Shan that he's speaking of. So he said, if your heart was like mine, oh, heart and mind, by the way, these are, in the Chinese, are it's really one word. But he said, if your heart was like mine, you'd be here. So that's what he's speaking. Because there's only this one place. It is called right here, right now, to be here. And in this is the freedom from insanity, fear, worry, struggle, striving, the need to control, and all the rest of that. The need for security and escape from pain. Yeah. So if your heart was like mine, if your heart was like mine, there's no mine here either. You see, this mine, he's speaking of the big self here, the true self, reality itself, and not this little ego. So if we continue to see this, what Han Shan is pointing to, as though Han Shan were confused and deluded, well, then we don't really see what he's pointing to. But in order to make this poem work, we have to understand that Han Shan was awake. Otherwise, it's just a piece of junk. It could be, it's just the same old kind of stuff we always read. It's this, and it sounds good. It sounds the same. You know? But if you put this in the context, this is a person who's awake speaking. It's not coming from ego. There's freedom in it. He's pointing to this great freedom. And so he says at the end, all I can say to those who meet, try and make it to Cold Mountain. So all I can say is, this is this invitation to just be here, to awaken to your own crazy mind, your grasping mind. This is all we need to do. And develop some appreciation for just how subtle this becomes. You know, and how easily caught up we are in this and that. We easily get turned around. And we cling in all kinds of ways. The subtlety of it is quite profound. This is something we need to come back to again and again, to remind ourselves of, to bring ourselves back. In 2 weeks, I'm going to be talking on the precepts. For those of you who've taken the precepts now before, please come back. In 3 weeks, we'll have a precept ceremony. But this is important that we come back. This isn't something you just do once. And I've taken these precepts. Okay, and now we leave it. No, you come back. We really should come back more often than I arrange it here. But you can do that on your own. This is what we need to do, to come back, to realize how it is that you're conducting yourself here, how it is that you're speaking, thinking, acting, what you're creating for yourself, what it is that you're demanding, what it is that you're shutting out. We need to remind ourselves of this. Otherwise, we spin out and we get entangled once again. Maybe we bring ourselves back and slowly we try to unsort that a little bit. And then we're, you know, entangled. But we have to make some effort here to work on this if we want to find this mind of freedom. Well, thank you very much. Do you have any questions or comments on what I've been saying here? Yeah, David.
Some of what gives us into trouble, I think, is curiosity. Like, turn over. I think the people that were manning power stations just wanted to see what would happen if they did this.
Is that right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could they bring the water level down to this point or something like that?
Yeah. Well, sure, the first time they ignited the first atomic bomb, there was a small chance because this had never been done before within the Earth's atmosphere. And there was a small chance that it could ignite the atmosphere. They weren't sure that it was a small chance. They didn't think it would. But there was a chance, based on their theories and what they knew, that it could ignite the atmosphere. Can you imagine? I mean, in other words, we are talking about there was a chance we could obliterate all of life on Earth. But probably not, so let's just go ahead and do it. We are absolutely insane. We are insane. We don't realize the depth of our confusion and our insanity. And I don't mean just those scientists at Chernobyl or at Trinity where they set off that bomb. I don't mean just those people. All of us even here, we are insane. It's not that we're bad or wrong or stupid because of that, but we should recognize just how crazy we are. Because the only way to spare ourselves, to save ourselves from this kind of confusion, is first of all, we have to realize that, to acknowledge that. As we do in the precept ceremony, the first thing we do is that formless acknowledgement. It's formless. We don't acknowledge this to anybody in particular. But we need to, first of all, realize just how foolish we can be. And once we take that step, then, you know, but you have to do that with some heart. You can't just do it kind of tossing it off. You have to mean that and do it. Take that step. But this is the first thing we need to do to come to grips. Because the stakes are getting high, folks. They're getting, you know, with this nanotechnology and other things. I mean, this is, we could very well be playing with extinction here. These are urgent issues. And, you know, humankind, we've matured in so many ways, especially with our technology. But emotionally, morally, we're still like dunces. And we got to grow up very fast now, I think, because of all the stuff that we've learned to do. And until we learn our sanity. Yeah, and we are very curious. Yeah, and there are those people out there who, I wonder if I could do this. But now we're playing with Ice Nine, you know. Do you know Ice Nine? A story by Kurt Vonnegut. Where these people, they're dealing with this stuff called Ice Nine. Ice Nine has this, it's fictional, of course, but this is the kind of stuff we're dealing with. Ice Nine has this peculiar property that any other water that touches Ice Nine becomes Ice Nine. And the book ends with a vial of this stuff falling in the Caribbean, I believe it is, or someplace like that. And of course, the ocean begins to freeze and ends with just kind of crystals falling out of the air, you know. Well, once again, the Kurt Vonnegut, there's another example. It's like we know this. It's in the back of our mind. But when are we going to take it? Part of it is we're too serious. It seems like too overwhelming a problem. Well, you know, we don't have any other choice but to deal with it. To take it seriously and to deal with it. For surely, all these stories that we've been hinting at about ourselves, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Frankenstein, and Ice Nine, we know this. We're going to do something. Is there going to be so much that we will wipe ourselves? Well, who knows? But certainly the possibility is there. We have to, all of us, each one, but you know, one by one, take this to heart and deal with it. Not go crazy. Settle down. Find that mind of Han Shan, that mind of Winter, to really just to learn to be and see in totality what is taking place here. And that it is all right here. We don't need to be reaching out for this or that, or trying to control them or these people. It's one of the things I really loved about Buddhism. It wasn't about telling you should be doing this or you should be doing that. It was about just take a look at what's going on here. I suppose if there's a should, it's just, why don't you do that? Why don't you just sit down, make yourself calm, make yourself sane. Instead of doing this or doing that, or you must do that, you must do this, wave these things and do that. So there's real sanity to this, but we have to understand what's at work here. We have to understand a little bit about ourselves and how crazy we are and misguided we are and all the rest of that. And then take it to heart, settle down. Well, sorry, David. But yes, curiosity. It killed the cat. Yes?
How do you balance the story? everyone was awake all the time and just, you know, aware of reality all the time. Isn't it really this curiosity, this cognitive dissonance with what is now versus what I want to be that drives, for lack of a better word, our progress? And I'll grant you that some of the progress we've made has not been so good, but some of it is very good.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you balance that so that we progress?
Progress? What progress?
Well, we got progression in science. We've also got
it looks like we have change, we have development, but what does it mean by progress? Are we happier now than people were, say, in the 18th century? You're nodding your head. Yeah.
I think there are parts of things that we've done, I'll say, in the technical and the sciences area that have been very good.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. And have benefited humanity.
Yes.
There are things we've done that haven't been so good. There are things that we've done in the sciences, I'll say sciences of the mind, and even what Buddhism does, I think, in the examining of the personal self and mind, that implies a certain curiosity that takes place. So I guess what I'm asking is, how do you balance this? It sounds almost like you're postulating an ideal of we're always awake, but always awake to reality, and therefore there's no grasping. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding something.
Yeah, I think you are. First of all, I have an insatiable curiosity. I've been a curious person from childhood on, and I still am. I'm always digging into things and looking at things. But, so I'm not about squelching that. I don't think, you know, that we shouldn't. But what are we curious about? Are we curious about something to make it better for me? This is the only point I'm making. It doesn't mean that we should sit on our hands and do nothing. I had a lot to do with the founding of this place, for example. So if I were saying, sit on your hands and do nothing, I suppose Dharma Field wouldn't have happened, you know. So I'm not saying that we can't do anything, that we shouldn't. But we need to see what it is that we are doing. And of course we have to act. It is impossible not to act. But the question is, do we want to act out of ignorance, or do we want to act out of seeing? And the only point, the only lesson I'm trying to bring home here is that we need to find out about this matter of awakening and seeing just what is really going on here and realizing how it is that we tend to remove ourselves from the experience and from the environment, from others, etc. And now we try to act in such a way, but we're acting out of the part. We're not acting out of totality. You know, we're acting out of the small mind. And that's where the problem is coming from. You know, so I'm not talking about shutting down of action or anything of that sort. Yeah. This is easily misunderstood, and I often have to come back and defend this point repeatedly, you know. So I understand, because it sounds like, it's just like in many ways too, this teaching is riddled with things that are easily taken completely backwards from what it looks like. Like Han Shan looks like he's arrogant and cold, and he's actually very warm-hearted and compassionate. You know, and the same thing here. It sounds like I'm saying we should shut all this down, shut it off. No, but I think we need to be looking at what is motivating us and what is driving us to do this or that. Learn to recognize when we're acting out of the ego mind, you know, not out of wholeness. You know. And that's another thing that's kind of related to what you were saying about this matter of want, that we might want to do this or, you know, or we need, when we are awake, this thing about what we need to do and what we want to do are not separated things. When we're deluded, this is another thing to tell us too. If you kind of pile your needs over here and your wants over here, that's a characteristic of a deluded mind. See if there's a way in which it's possible to bring these two piles of things together so they coincide. Were you to actually accomplish that, this would be an awakened mind. I'm not saying that somehow you can somehow drag these together and now in your mind you're going to be awake. It doesn't quite work that way, but it's just that with awakening, we don't see these things as parsed out in that way. So then it's like need and want are together, you know. And that's kind of another characteristic of heart and mind, you know, needn't want to, are found to be in the same territory, same space. And action will be there. Action will be needed to be taken. What motivates a person who is awake is action toward awakening. What motivates us when we're not awake is action to deal with the self, you know, to protect the self, to please the self. Even through acts of altruism, where we seem to be selfless in some way, if we're not awake, there's still self involved in it. And as a result, there's going to be problems. Okay, well, we've probably gone over here a bit, so I better end it. So, thank you very much.